Miller Center of Public Affairs is pleased to welcome you to a rotunda lecture by Father Brian Hare, a senior research scholar at the Kennedy Institute of Ethics and senior research professor at Georgetown University. Father Hare is a principal author. That's the most cautious possible way of expressing it, of the Catholic bishop's letter, pastoral letter on the nuclear problem. He is widely respected throughout the community of secular international relations scholars. He holds the doctor's degree from Harvard University. He participates in scholarly discussions on international relations throughout the country. He's been successful in an unparalleled way in attracting to the discussions of the Catholic bishops the foremost policymakers, thinkers, and writers on problems of nuclear concern. His discussion today will be on the U.S. nuclear debate, strategic and ethical aspects. It's a privilege for the Miller Center to entertain in this lecture Father Brian Hare.
Thank you very much. It is obviously a privilege to come to this university and to this wonderful building. It has the feeling of a cathedral about it. I guess I'm in an appropriate position to be able to say that. But it is also a privilege to be able to come for a dear and valued old friend and teacher and mentor, Ken Thompson. As soon as I began to study international relations, the name Thompson surfaced, and it's been there all along. So I regard this as a privilege in many different ways. What I propose to do this afternoon is to look at the state of the nuclear debate in the United States, the role of moral analysis in the debate, and as part of that discussion, the role of the Catholic Bishop's letter on war and peace, published in 1983 and entitled The Challenge of Peace. Essentially, I'd like to proceed through the argument in three steps. I'd like to talk about the character of the nuclear debate, at least as I see it in 1986. Secondly, the role of moral argument in the debate. And thirdly, the future agenda, again, as I see it. The character of the nuclear debate. In writing the pastoral letter on war and peace, the bishops opened the letter with a discussion of what they called a new moment in the nuclear age. And what they meant by a new moment was not new warheads, new technology, or new tensions between East and West. They particularly focused upon the quality and character and intensity of the public policy debate surrounding nuclear weapons that emerged in the early 1980s. I think that debate continues till today, and although it has evidenced some shifts since the early 1980s, I still think it is possible to focus on the particular characteristics of the debate, which are not only interesting in purely strategic terms, but are particularly interesting in terms of the intersection of strategic questions and moral questions. Indeed, one of the characteristics of the debate of the 80s is the visibility of moral argument in the midst of the technical strategic debate. I would discuss the character of the nuclear debate in terms of two stages, two levels. First, the public or popular argument about nuclear weapons, and secondly, the policy argument. Now, my contention is that both at the popular level and at the policy level, there have been significant shifts in the nuclear debate in the 80s that are interesting to assess. The popular argument, I think, is noticeable in the first instance simply by the fact that it exists. I would submit that at the level of non-professional participation and analysis in the United States, at what the level of what one might call the citizen interest in the nuclear question, For much of the nuclear age, there was not in evidence any stable constituency interested in the nuclear question. We had spurts of interest at different moments, but until the early 1980s, I submit you did not have a sustained public interest by non-specialists in the nuclear issue. In the early 1980s, I think that changed. There erupted a public constituency concerned about the direction of American nuclear policy. It is difficult to identify exactly the sources of this eruption, but the fact, I think, is clear. It was composed by a series of subgroups, if you will, this public constituency, and I can cite some of them. For example, the Freeze Movement. The Freeze Movement is interesting, I submit, not because of its answer to the nuclear question. The answer is entirely debatable and has been debated. The significance of the Freeze Movement is that it began in town meetings in Vermont and city council meetings in California, and it had a genius for drawing into the discussion of nuclear policy at a fairly significant level of sophistication ordinary citizens. The Freeze Movement, however, did not stand alone. The engagement of the physicians in the nuclear question has also impacted the way we think about and talk about nuclear weapons. The physicians generally, I think, had an impact for the following reasons. First of all, they carry a certain kind of authority in American public mind. Physicians do. Secondly, they are generally regarded as not being politically involved. And so their involvement in a highly political issue was noticeable. And thirdly, I think the physicians played to their comparative advantage. That is to say, they specifically looked at the consequences of using nuclear weapons understood in medical terms. And that not only meant they played from their strength, they also tended to talk about the nuclear question in a way that ordinary citizens could understand. So the Freeze and the physicians, and then thirdly, the religious organizations. Once again, not that they had never been in the discussion before, but they entered it in the 80s with a certain kind of character, a certain kind of intensity. Now, I also think that that intensity with which they and these other groups entered the discussion by itself would not have created this public movement. There was something out there in the public mind that made people attuned to arguments that had been made before, but now were being made with a new saliency. In my own view, if the American Catholic bishops had said exactly the same thing in 1972 and 73 that they said in 82 and 83, it never would have made the same impact. There was just not the kind of national attention to the issue in the early 70s. And so these groups together, the Freeze, the physicians, and religious organizations, constituted, if you will, a citizens' constituency about nuclear weapons. I think it is fair to say that that constituency is clearer about what it is against than what it is for. That is to say, it is against the use of nuclear weapons, against resort to nuclear war. I suspect if we do get a concrete arms control agreement on the table, you will divide the constituency about whether it ought to be supported or not. Secondly, however, even though they were clearer about what they were against than what they were for, I think the public constituency had a certain impact in the first 5 years of the 1980s. I think to some degree it brought the Reagan administration to the table with a proposal, first on INF and then eventually on the START negotiations. And secondly, it has permanently, I think, marked the character of the public debate that you were able to mobilize this kind of citizen involvement. I will come back to the question about whether it can be sustained at a later point in the lecture. The final point I would make about this popular engagement, however, is that by itself, it would not have been enough to really reshape the content of the nuclear debate. But it did not exist by itself. At a second level of public argument in the United States in the 80s, we have had shifts in the policy debate. Now, by the policy debate, I really mean the elite debate on nuclear weapons, the discussion that has gone on for most of the nuclear age. And whereas I argued earlier that there was hardly any citizen involvement for much of the nuclear age, the policy debate certainly has been visible, tangible, and vocal throughout the nuclear age. It has been an elite debate in the sense that you could identify the places where the debate took place. Inside the U.S. government, in a few major think tanks, and in a relatively few major universities. It was in those places that the elite policy debate took place. One of the characteristics of the nuclear policy debate has been its remarkably consensual character. That is to say, if you look at most of the nuclear age, I think it is fair to say that the policy or elite debate took place within a fairly well-defined framework, that you could go from a Democratic administration to a Republican administration to a Democratic administration and not have major shifts in American nuclear policy. Not the kind of shift we were accustomed to think of in terms of aspects of domestic policy. It was as if there were a few self-evident premises about nuclear weapons and how one thought about them, and that they perdured through different forms of the way you would declare your nuclear policy or argue it. At the core, there was not a great deal of shifting. There was a strong consensus. Now, I submit, in terms of the character of the nuclear debate of the 80s, one of the characteristics, along with the emergence of a popular level of interest, has been the emergence of significant stress on what I might call the nuclear consensus. There has been stress pre-Reykjavik, and I submit there is new stress post-Reykjavik. Let me try and sketch what I mean. The stress on the consensus that first emerged in the early 80s, and one can again exemplify it in a number of different examples. A first sign of stress on the consensus was the publication in 1982 of the article authored by McGeorge Bundy, Robert McNamara, George Kennan, and Gerard Smith. Now, these four people represent the elite policy debate. They have helped shape American nuclear policy, explain it, negotiate for it, and they have served both Democratic and Republican administrations. In 1982, as you know, in the journal Foreign Affairs, which represents that elite policy debate in a very significant way, these four people said that the NATO countries ought to rethink and reverse what had been fundamental NATO policy for 38 years, the willingness, if necessary, to use nuclear weapons first to stop a conventional attack in Central Europe. The question about whether they were right or not is really a secondary question for my purpose. The point is, four people of that character and background and experience challenging a central premise of NATO policy that had been unchallenged for 38 years made news in itself. But they were not the only signs of stress on the consensus. If that was 82, the stress on the consensus in 83 was not just the Catholic bishops. In 83, there was secular stress on the consensus, and it was embodied in the Scowcroft Report. The Scowcroft Commission, as you know, was put together by the President of the United States, and its mandate was to review the purpose and future of American strategic nuclear forces. The subordinate purpose, but the driving force of the Scowcroft Commission, was to get the MX missile through the Congress. The commission was composed of people who would have to be defined as centrist to moderate right. There was, in a sense, no radical opinion on the commission. They produced a tightly written document that is still useful to read to this day. But the document I submit, as well done as it is, illustrates the inner tensions of the nuclear debate in the 80s. For I think without at all caricaturing the document, you can say the Scowcroft Commission reached the following three conclusions. First, they took a look at the question of the window of vulnerability. That was the question, in a sense, they were assigned. That is to say, whether American land-based nuclear forces would be vulnerable to a successful Soviet first strike in the late 80s or early 90s. That was the debate that was driving the MX missile at that time. The Scowcroft Commission gently said, the window of vulnerability is not open. Secondly, the Scowcroft Commission said, the building of land-based multi-warhead missiles is a bad thing for nuclear stability on both sides. Thirdly, the Scowcroft Commission said, the United States should proceed to build a land-based multi-warhead missile to close the window of vulnerability that doesn't exist. There is not, I think, a contradiction in all of those terms if you read the whole report. But to read it at face value, one sees the inner tension of the existing nuclear debate. And then thirdly, the tension or the stress on the consensus that had sustained American nuclear policy for almost three decades. The consensus was challenged most openly by the President of the United States. In March of 1983, in the proposal to move to the Strategic Defense Initiative, the President challenged the operating premises of American nuclear policy for several years. He challenged it in the sense that he sought to transform the nature of the nuclear relationship from offense to defense. At this point, I'm not prepared to talk at this point in the lecture about whether that's wise or not. It is simply useful to recognize intellectually that that kind of proposal runs head-on into what had been the guiding premises of American nuclear policy at least since the early 1960s and had been embodied in the ABM Treaty of 1972. Now, what you have here is a rather remarkable picture of stress on a policy consensus that had existed for a long time and that was a central issue that one does not easily shift on. An exemplification of these different pressures on the consensus, I submit, is the fact that by the middle of the 1980s, the term that had held together the American nuclear debate, the, in a sense, consensus term, namely deterrence, was under attack from both the left and the right. By the middle of the 1980s, the notion of deterrence was under attack from the left and the right of the political spectrum, and both the left and the right lodged a political and a moral case against deterrence. The left, in a sense, argued politically and morally that deterrence was too dangerous to be sustained over the long term. And the president himself argued that deterrence was immoral and secondly, that it did not allow us to deal with the Soviet threat as it was being posed in terms of a threat to our land-based missiles. So the deterrence itself, rather than becoming the term that defined the debate that everyone understood and agreed upon, and then we argued about what kind of deterrence, how much deterrence, what form, force structure, targeting doctrine, deterrence itself came under question. And so you find in standard journals of foreign policy analysis, articles that talk about deterrence as the problem, not the solution. And on the other hand, you find people who say it is necessary and good to discuss American nuclear policy, but don't challenge deterrence. Leon Wieseltier in The New Republic and in a small book he wrote on the nuclear question in the early 80s said the Catholic bishops were about right in most of their policy prescriptions. But Wieseltier said the fundamental flaw of the letter is that it has unveiled the fragility of deterrence as a notion in its moral terms and strategic terms. And he said that is what is undoable because there is no place else to go but deterrence. Now this discussion, the character of the nuclear discussion, was particularly evident in the period from about 80 to 84, the first Reagan administration, that one had popular dissent or popular concern about the direction of American nuclear policy, and one had in the policy debate this fracturing, if you will, of views. I submit by the middle of the 1980s, we have yet to glue the consensus back together. And once again, I'm still in pre-Reykjavik commentary. Let me simply cite two authors who are totally identified with the shaping of the consensus on American nuclear policy, who stand in somewhat different positions about where we ought to go at this time. Last year, again in Foreign Affairs, Thomas Schelling, from whom many of us learned the very way of thinking about nuclear weapons in his early works. Schelling wrote an article in Foreign Affairs asking what went wrong with arms control. And in Schelling's view, we conceptually and diplomatically had an approach to arms control that was right from 1958 through 1972. And then, as he put it, from 72 on, we have lost our way. We have forgotten the consensus about how you relate arms control to strategic planning. Essentially, Schelling argues that after 72, we went in a direction where we focused on numbers of weapons rather than the character of weapons, and we started from that shift to move progressively away from the key ideas that had formed the arms control consensus. On the other hand, in Newsweek, the week before the president went to Reykjavik, Henry Kissinger argued that people who had developed the arms control consensus were now married to old ideas they were not willing to give up. And because they were married to old ideas they were not willing to give up, they did not understand that the consensus that had guided arms control policy for 20 years was no longer sufficient. Now, specifically, Kissinger was sought to make room for the defensive option as part of the overall approach of American nuclear policy. But my point is, Schelling and Kissinger helped to shape, to write the charter of the nuclear consensus. And now we find them in very different places, arguing for very different approaches. Schelling for a return to the faith, if you will, Kissinger for opening up a new church. And so one finds at the policy debate, the elite debate, very significant differences of views on where we ought to go. Move to post-Reykjavik. Once again, looked at from the point of view of how we think about nuclear weapons and nuclear policy. The major discussions at Reykjavik are deep cuts and the SDI. And by espousing both of them in the strongest possible terms, to some degree, President Reagan comes home from Reykjavik to the left and the right of the arms control consensus at the same time. His proposal for very deep cuts, meaning by that doing away with ballistic missiles entirely within the next 10 years, and or all nuclear weapons, however Reykjavik is interpreted, immediately brought responses from people who had shaped and protected the consensus that had undergirded American nuclear policy. James Schlesinger in the Washington Post, 3 days after Reykjavik, said, "Let no one tell you that there is any escape from deterrence. There is no escape. We can go no farther than we've gone. This is the best you can do with a nuclear world. And therefore, let us understand we have reached here a fundamental point conceptually that we must stay with." On the other hand, the SDI proposal, in a sense, is quotes to the right of the arms control consensus. For once again, it seeks to shift the conception of the nuclear age from an offensive-dominated age where, in a sense, the best you can do is to deter in the direction of an offensive-defensive mix or, in its outer extreme, the transition to a fully defensive world. Now, it is this kind of discussion about what are the ideas that should undergird our policy, what negotiating strategy should be followed, and what is the desirable outcome of seeking to live in a nuclear world? Is the desirable outcome to move aggressively toward a world in which there is at least no ballistic missiles or no nuclear weapons at all? Or, as the standard arms control consensus would put it, once you have invented the weapons and people know how to make them, there is no escape from a nuclear world. The question is, how do you live with the weapons, to use the Harvard study of the early 80s? There is no alternative to living with the weapons, and that usually means living with deterrence. Where should we move? That, I submit, is the state of the character of the debate by the mid-1980s. Now, my second point is that if you look at the nuclear debate of the 80s, one of the characteristics that I have not traced thus far but is there is the way the moral argument runs through the policy debate and the public debate. The public or popular discussion of nuclear weapons is cast in terms in which the public's interest is expressed, often expressed in terms of fear, and to some degree people argued that the upsurge or the emergence of the popular debate in the early 80s was a product of the fact that there were no arms control discussions going on and that the rhetoric of the Reagan administration seemed to communicate to the public a sense that they thought these weapons were usable. The public response to that was fear and uncertainty, but it quickly was easily transformed into discussions of the morality of these weapons. And if one looks at the physicians who start with a medical analysis, they quickly move towards some kind of moral statement about what it means to live in the nuclear world and the nuclear age and what we ought to do about it. The religious organizations obviously dealt with the question in terms of moral analysis. But what was also interesting was at the level of policy discussion, the elite discussion, the emergence of moral argument at the center of the policy debate became a characteristic in the 80s that was simply not there in the 60s and 70s. I am not saying nobody dealt with the morality of nuclear weapons. Ken Thompson was one of several that did. David Little here, Jim Childress here. People did deal with the questions of ethics and nuclear strategy, but for the most part, the moralists lived in one world and the strategists lived in another. If they read each other's literature, that was the most they did. But you seldom found the two points of view brought together in the same publication, the same journals, the same policy papers, the same conferences. It really was a different discussion at that time. Today, in most of the major policy journals, in most of the public discussion, and of course preeminently in the SDI discussion, the moral argument is used from the beginning, used differently by different people. I will come to that. But my first point is simply the visibility of the moral argument. Prior to the 80s, people had tried to discuss the morality of nuclear weapons. You could distinguish three different positions that developed between the 60s and the 80s. The first position, represented by, for example, Professor Paul Ramsey at Princeton, argued that nuclear weapons were different but not qualitatively different from other forms of weaponry. Therefore, the morally responsible position was to take the classical moral principles that said some use of force is morally acceptable, but every morally acceptable use of force must be a limited use of force, and you should shape nuclear policy according to those principles. And so Ramsey argued for a policy of justifiable use of nuclear weapons under some circumstances and justifiable deterrent. Just as Ramsey wrote that position, a second body of opinion was growing up in the 1960s that took a radically different approach to nuclear weapons, even though it started at the same place Ramsey started. It began with an assertion that some use of force in international affairs was morally acceptable, but every use of force must be a limited use of force. But from these principles, for example, a body of Catholic moralists in the 1960s, in a book edited by Walter Stein in London, argued that nuclear weapons could never meet the test of the standard classical just war analysis, that every use of nuclear weapons would inevitably go beyond either the principle of discrimination or proportionality. And this body of opinion said, although we believe some use of force is morally permissible, we have come to a conclusion of nuclear pacifism. They argued for a posture that would say that people who held their moral position would not cooperate with nuclear strategy in any form. Now, the Ramsey and Stein positions have 1980s versions. Professor William O'Brien of Georgetown has argued the case for justifiable nuclear use and deterrence. Michael Novak at the American Enterprise Institute has argued the same case. The Stein position has been re-argued again by Anthony Kenney, an English philosopher who just published a book called The Logic of Nuclear Deterrence. A third position that developed in the 1970s was Michael Walzer's position in his book Just and Unjust Wars. Walzer clearly disagreed with Ramsey that nuclear weapons were like other forms of weaponry. He argued that nuclear weapons were in fact qualitatively different. Secondly, he said on the question of the use of nuclear weapons, he said any use of nuclear weapons will burst the bonds of the classical moral theory. They're unusable. But Walzer said, I am not prepared to go in the direction of the English Catholics. I am not prepared to argue that because I can't think of a justifiable use, I will condemn the strategy of deterrence. He called the situation of deterrence supreme emergency and argued that in the supreme emergency, you would justify what you would not normally justify. He therefore justified preparation for nuclear war, an intention to be prepared to stand against an adversary in nuclear war, and recognize that the actual use, in his mind, would always be immoral. These three positions were there when the Catholic bishops went to write in the early 1980s. They developed a position that falls someplace between Ramsey and Walzer. Essentially, they wrote a moral religious analysis of a series of political, technological, and strategic questions. They purposely drove the argument to the level of specific policy judgments as well as a statement of moral principles. Essentially, their view was that nuclear weapons are qualitatively different. Secondly, on the question of the use of nuclear weapons, they took up three cases of use and examined them, argued against any directly intended use against civilian centers, argued on prudential grounds against first use of nuclear weapons, and on the question of limited second use of nuclear weapons, they raised a whole series of skeptical reservations, but they refused to say that any use of nuclear weapons under any circumstances in any way would always be wrong. So to some degree, they are more flexible on use than Stein, and yet much less flexible than Ramsey. On the question of deterrence, their judgment was what they called strictly conditioned moral acceptance of deterrence. Essentially, the judgment is just barely justifiable. They had a number of moral problems with the dynamic of deterrence and the way it functions in international politics. On the other hand, they were not prepared to say that they felt it had no moral legitimacy whatsoever. This conditional judgment of deterrence was somewhat different than either Ramsey or Stein, and also somewhat different than Walzer. Now, post the pastoral letter, where are we in this discussion of ethics and nuclear policy? Some have argued that the pastoral letter tended to crystallize the moral debate about ethics and strategy and helped to generate a whole body of literature that has come since the pastoral letter. I think we probably did have a catalytic effect, and that's the most useful effect, because no one body of people can, with any degree of certitude, claim to solve this question, in quotes. So today we have a rather robust debate about ethics and strategy. But there are different views among people about what role moral analysis adds to strategic policy. I submit there are four different views about the role of ethics and policy. One view says ethics is superfluous. A second says it is decisive. A third says it is corruptive of strategic discourse. And a fourth says it is complementary to strategic analysis. In other words, the point I'm trying to make here is the question one asks is, does moral analysis add anything to, in a sense, secular policy analysis or not? And if it does add anything, what does it add? The argument that moral analysis is superfluous essentially says moral analysis may be interesting, but it does not tell you anything you cannot learn from good, sound strategic analysis. Essentially, the view is moral analysis is not necessary for sound strategic policy. A second view that says moral analysis is decisive would be the kind of view that is reflected in the Stein volume. That is to say, the Stein volume of the English Catholic moralist finally came to a conclusion that they felt that no effective deterrent could be launched that did not include within it the intention to use nuclear weapons against cities as a direct target. And once they understood that, in a sense, they withdrew from the nuclear debate. For they said any policy that embodies that principle cannot be discussed in a way that one understands moral justification of it. So moral analysis there appears to be decisive. Once you know something, the rest of the empirical discussion does not interest one. There are other people who feel that once you know something morally, you can withdraw from the empirical discussion, but they come to very different conclusions. I think Jerry Falwell thinks he has found a moral principle in terms of his view of the Soviet Union, that it is so totally evil that whatever you have to do to deal with it must be morally acceptable. So once again, whether you look at the nuclear pacifist or Jerry Falwell, moral argument is decisive. It tends to dispense with strategic complexity once you understand the right moral principle. A third view is that moral analysis is corruptive of strategic debate, of sound strategic debate. It is a view that is gently proposed by George Questor, a longtime participant in the strategic debate in the United States. Questor essentially says this: I understand that the key moral principle in the classical moral theory is that direct attacks on civilian populations are wrong. And I understand the classical moral theory would also say if you cannot attack those civilians, you cannot intend to attack them. Now, Questor's point is that once you understand that principle and you begin to apply it to strategic doctrine, you will challenge what has been at the heart of the stability of deterrence for most of the nuclear age. Questor, in a sense, argues we are inevitably confronted with the threat to attack civilian populations. That is in the nature of strategic deterrence. And attempts to move away from that in the direction of counterforce targeting, in the direction of warfighting strategies that rely less on deterrence and more on a credible threat to use the weapons, Questor says you will end up with exactly the wrong kind of world. You will make nuclear war more likely, you will certainly make the arms race more costly, and the outcome of your moral analysis is that you corrupt good, clear strategic thinking. Now, a final view says that moral analysis is complementary to strategic analysis. That is to say, that if you use the moral analysis, it helps you to open up the strategic argument in certain ways. And while the moral analysis is not decisive in the sense that you can proceed with it apart from strategic knowledge, the point is the strategic assessment without the moral analysis is less adequate as a policy perspective. Let me try and exemplify a complementary notion of ethics and strategy by just commenting on the SDI debate. In the SDI debate, the president says the SDI is a superior moral answer to the nuclear age, while other people in the administration and while in the academic community, we debate the specifics of the SDI, what it would look like, whether we can do it, what impact it has on arms control negotiations. The president in his speeches seldom gets into those details. He simply says this is the superior moral position to what we have lived with in the nuclear age, and that's why I'm committed to pursue it. What does he mean by that? What he means by that is it is my intention by pursuing this policy precisely to move the nuclear threat not only away from civilian centers and cities, I plan to move it away from military targets and from any earthly reality. We will put it in space. It will be weapons against weapons in the atmosphere. And therefore, morally, we will insulate the human community from this threat to nuclear weapons. Now, I understand that the next day, somebody in the administration will say, what we're really interested in is not population defense, but point defense. But it is interesting that the president sustains the argument about population defense as the leading edge of the way the SDI is sold. And he casts it in moral terms. Now, how does one respond to that? This is now a moral argument at the heart of selling a strategic policy. My own sense is that at the level of intention of what he plans to do, it is hard to make a moral critique out of protecting the human race from nuclear weapons. It is very difficult to find a moral flaw in the argument. The difficulty is that good moral analysis will also say that the analysis of a policy can never rest at the level of intention alone.
one must also ask about the consequences of pursuing one's intention. And there, if you press the consequences of pursuing the SDI, I do not say you solve the SDI debate, but you force the judgment about the morality of the SDI from the level of what the intention of the policy is to three other levels. You force it to the level of technical analysis, technological analysis, what can be done in the SDI. Secondly, you force it to the level of strategic analysis. What will be the impact on the strategic balance of precisely moving in an offensive-defensive mix? And thirdly, you force it to the level of economic analysis. What will be the cost of SDI in comparison to other costs that the nation faces? And secondly, what will be the cost of SDI in comparison to other defense needs? Now, it's not my purpose to go through that argument. I'm simply saying that if you cast the moral judgment about SDI only at the level of intention, you have dispensed with all the critical questions technologically, strategically, and economically. So a complementary view of ethics and strategy, I think, is that moral argument opens up the strategic debate, but that moral argument by itself is not sufficient to close or finalize your judgment on a given policy or on the nuclear age as a whole. Final comments about the future agenda of the nuclear debate. I'm really looking now at the period from 86 through the end of the century, or at least 86 through the next 10 years. First of all, the future agenda in terms of the public argument. Something occurred in the early 80s in the sense of citizen involvement in the nuclear question, and the issue that faces us for the short to middle term, now to the end of the century, is whether that citizen engagement will be sustained. I have no doubt that the citizen engagement made a certain impact in the early 80s. Secondly, I have no doubt that the intensity of the citizen engagement is not the same today as it was in the early 80s. But my question is in between those two. It is, what is the long-term sustainability of a citizens' coalition around the nuclear question? I don't think you will have the ongoing intensity of the debate from 82 to 84, but I do think people who became interested in that question are still interested. The question is the development over the long term. I think citizen involvement is absolutely crucial. It is precisely because the elite debate is such a tightly contained debate that it is necessary, I think, that it be tested against the common wisdom of people who are targets in the nuclear age as well as citizens of a nuclear nation. And so I am not arguing for ignorance versus knowledge. I am arguing for the kind of moderate understanding, modest understanding of the nuclear discussion that I think citizens can have. And if I can point out one case where I think the lack of citizen involvement had a long-term impact on the nuclear discussion, I think it would be to contrast the decision to MIRV nuclear weapons at the beginning of the 70s with the discussion about MX at the beginning of the 80s. If we had had the kind of public scrutiny of MIRVing in the early 70s that we had of MX in the early 80s, it is very likely we might have gone in a different direction on MIRVing. Because in the elite debate, we decided quickly to MIRV nuclear weapons, and today almost no one in the strategic debate thinks that a MIRVed world is a safer world. Henry Kissinger, who presided over the MIRVing of American nuclear strategy, said in the Newsweek article, the first objective of arms control is to go back to an un-MIRVed world. Now, there was no public engagement in that question. There was in the MX, and I think we were better for it. At the policy level, what is the future agenda? I think two questions. First, conceptual questions, and secondly, diplomatic questions. The conceptual questions, in a sense, pick up from the first part of my lecture. If you chart the nuclear age over the last 40 years, you go through certain periods that are critical in the development of nuclear strategy, as opposed to other periods that are more organic, where no new ideas really surface. If one looks at the period from 1958 to 62, we helped to shape a whole discourse that sustained the nuclear consensus. Today, I submit precisely the kind of pressure on that consensus that I tried to illustrate in the first part of the lecture says that we are in a critical rather than organic period. That is to say, there is flux today in the way we think about these weapons, as well as how we decide what we're going to build and what we're going to pursue as a strategy. The question conceptually is, I think, the refashioning of a consensus that is viable. Whether it's right to simply repeat the faith of the 60s and the ideas that were then shaped, or whether it really is necessary to redo the consensus from the ground up, that still is an open question. But to my mind, one cannot escape the fundamental level that the debate has reached. We are conceptually fractured in the discussion today, and the question about where we go is, I think, all over the op-ed pages, and how we're going to shape it is an open question. Secondly, from the conceptual disagreement, we then have disagreements about diplomatic negotiating strategy. The three things that were there in Reykjavik, deep cuts, SDI, and testing, are all on the table as debates. They are not on the table as things we are united behind. The deep cuts argument appeals to much of the citizen involvement in the nuclear question. Many of the arms control professionals say deep cuts by themselves don't mean that much, and done in a certain way, they can be dangerous. And so we have dispute. SDI, obviously, is debatable among the scientists and among the politicians and among the nuclear specialists. And testing itself, rather than being something that was just difficult to find a way to do, has become part of the debate about whether we ought to do it. The moral argument that surfaced in the 80s, I think, has signs of having staying power. That is to say, I think its visibility in the nuclear debate will not easily go away, but the moral argument, like the strategic argument, has to be formed and reformed in ways that are compatible with, or at least correspond to, the shifting strategic debate. The moral assessment must complement the strategic debate. By itself, it cannot answer the questions of the strategic debate. This is the way I see the discussion in the middle of the 1980s. We have gone through, I think, a period of surprising innovation, if you will, in both the way the public looks at nuclear weapons and in the way the professionals look at it. And we stand at a point where we're faced with shaping a consensus that is both conceptually coherent, diplomatically useful, and publicly acceptable. And that, I take it, is the task of the decade. Thank you very much.
Father Hare has kindly consented to ask any questions you have. We probably should have a limited time period for this because of the other arrangements for this room. But who would like to ask the first question? Yes.
Dan Lang.
If the Catholic bishops were bringing the proposal, would they have tabled or accepted?
If the Catholic bishops were at Reykjavik, what would they have tabled or accepted? Well, the Pope told us not to be politicians, so we couldn't have been at Reykjavik, but that's the easy way out. If one looks at the letter of 1983, it has the following characteristics about it. In terms of offensive weapons, I think the letter directs one to be interested in significant cuts in the offensive arsenals, and secondly, qualitative constraints over the nuclear arsenal, so that we were quite strongly in favor of deep cuts, and I think would be, and I personally would be. I think the argument Joe Nye makes in the recent foreign affairs that the deep cuts that are being talked about, one can make all of those and not get into the danger area of cutting so deeply that you can end up with nuclear instability. So deep cuts from the level at which we are presently at, I think, would be something the letter would support. The letter did not address the defensive issue at all. it was a reflection of the state of the debate at the time. The president's March speech was came out just as we had finished the final draft of the letter. There was no serious possibility of doing an adequate assessment of the defensive option. There is now a new committee of the Bishops' Conference that has been empowered to submit a report, or mandated to submit a report next November, that is looking at the nuclear discussion 4 years after the letter. The SDI will have to be addressed in that question, and we will have to then deal with the specific policy implications. So I'm afraid we might have been mute at Reykjavik on just using the letter. We would have been strongly, I think, in favor of deep cuts on the offensive side. We were in favor of, and I think good reason, in favor of comprehensive test ban. I would argue that it is doable, and it strikes at precisely the relationship between technological change and the inability of setting political limits to that technological change that has bedeviled the nuclear arms race. So I think we would still be in favor of a testing ban.
Yes, sir.
Could you comment on your feeling about the linkage of the arms race with human rights?
The linkage question, it seems to me, has to be faced at two levels. One level is conscious policy, that is to say, developing a conscious policy of linking nuclear questions to other issues, whether it be human rights or regional conflict. And then secondly, there is a linkage that the public makes whether you have a policy designed in that direction or not. So there, to some degree, you have to deal with linkage as a fact, even if you haven't built it in as a conscious policy option. Now, my sense is that one cannot totally isolate nuclear weapons from the rest of the foreign policy agenda, because the weapons themselves are reflections of political tensions between the superpowers. So in that sense, I am not for a conceptual approach that would isolate nuclear weapons from everything else in the world. At the same time, I think you can argue for a priority within the available foreign policy agenda, a priority to be given to setting limits on the nuclear question and to directing the nuclear relationship in a way that lessens the danger of nuclear war over the long term. And therefore, I think the fusing at the policy level of an explicit linkage between human rights and the nuclear question doesn't seem to me to be, in the long run, a viable policy. It is hard enough to get any constraints at all on the nuclear question. When you introduce other factors as a condition, that's the point, as a condition for coming to agreement, I think you then force the nuclear agenda to bear a burden it cannot bear. And so, to some degree, I think there is great wisdom in what Andrei Sakharov said. As I understand what Sakharov said, he said, keep pressing the human rights issue as a foreign policy objective, but don't make the human rights issue a block to a reasonable arms control agreement. I think that's good policy wisdom. I have one in the back, and then I'll come back. Yes, and I'm looking over here, so I won't.
Do you think that the critique of deterrence from the left, the moral left,
the moral left,
the Kenny position, Wolfenstein position, has the somewhat paradoxical effect of reinforcing the president's approach on SDR?
Yes. Well, it certainly can be used that way. That is to say, maybe I ought to be clear about what the critique from the left is. The critique from the left essentially says we cannot think of any morally acceptable use of nuclear weapons, and we cannot accept deterrence because inherent in deterrence is the firm intention to use these weapons in a way that is not morally acceptable. Therefore, by that intention, you are already morally implicated in evil. The answer this is a radical left, it's not politically radical, it's philosophically radical. Philosophically radically left position is to say the only thing you can do in the face of nuclear strategy is to be a dissenter, is to withdraw and stand against it. Now, obviously, such an indictment of deterrence means that you must find something else, and the president then proposes that he has got something else. So in a way, there is a convergence, if you will, in the arguments. You will seldom find a convergence at the policy level. That is to say, the left in its critique of deterrence, when they listen to the SDI, say, tend not to support it in policy terms. But at a functional level, you get a certain kind of intersection. Politics tends to bring together strange allies, and it has in this instance. Yes, sir.
We focused exclusively on nuclear weapons this afternoon, and that is your topic, but I wonder if you'd tell us your moral view of the use of increasingly sophisticated and highly destructive non-nuclear weapons.
Well, the nuclear conventional linkage is worth another lecture in itself, both in political terms and in moral terms, because it poses very serious problems for anyone who again tries to write on nuclear weapons in isolation. You raise the following questions in addition to yours. Of course, one question that one raises immediately is one that the bishops simply dealt with in one sentence, and I'm not saying the one sentence was adequate, but we had to do something. We said at one point in the argument, it is not our intention through pressing for nuclear control and disarmament to make the world safe for conventional war. And of course, in the European theater, that is a very strong focus. That is to say, Europeans may be uncomfortable with deterrence, at least some of them, but they are equally uncomfortable with a notion that you would think about the East-West relationship devoid of nuclear weapons. And that's why the European concerns after Reykjavik were immediate. But that's also a moral question. That is to say, in pressing the nuclear agenda, do you raise the risk of resort to force in a conventional way that would be enormously damaging? Secondly, the character of conventional war in our time, as you point out, becomes increasingly technologized and sophisticated, and so you have some of the same problems with the upper levels of conventional war that have created the crisis in moral argument about nuclear weapons. That is to say, if your conviction is that the only legitimate use of force is a limited use of force, this increasingly technological battlefield, while it increases accuracy in all of that, the experience of it, to some degree, is that you will have a difficult time setting limits. So I think that the assessment of the conventional question in both political, strategic, and moral terms must be carried along with the nuclear question. And many of us have been fascinated by the nuclear issue, fixated on it, let me put it that way, in a way that doesn't help. On the other hand, it is hard to argue every case competently, and so one needs to have a little division of labor here, even if you keep the policy framework tight enough to deal with both of them. Yes, sir.
You said that the theory of war fighting makes war more likely. Is it your opinion that Reagan's buildup of counterforce weapons like the MX and Trident that possess accurate first strike potential and defensive systems like SDI that could possess the capability to make our land-based ICBM survivable could constitute a war-fighting policy?
Well, first of all, we need not only to press it in terms of this administration. There has been a move. This was part of the shift in the consensus. There was a move since the mid-70s in the direction of more warfighting capability. It has never been a clear divide between deterrence and warfighting. It's never been that clean cut. Those are good conceptual categories to state the problem, but it always gets more mixed in the reality of the situation. However, you had a move toward increasing capabilities and increasing thought given to warfighting capabilities at the end of the Carter administration from about 78 on. It resulted in the PD-59 directive, which moved in the direction of developing warfighting options. In the early 70s, Secretary Schlesinger, precisely to deal with what he understood to be the moral question of unlimited use of nuclear weapons, developed a body of options he called the Selective Options Policy. So Selective Options PD-59 predated some of the moves of the Reagan administration. However, it has been intensified in the Reagan administration, and the argument has been partly moral, partly tactical or strategic. The problem about first strike and first strike of nuclear weapons or the tendency to use nuclear weapons is that the dynamic of your own policy can push you that way. That is to say, you develop a series of options, and in a crisis, people begin to think if the options are there, we ought to resort to them. The second problem is how your adversary sees what you intend. You may not intend either in an offensive-defensive mix or in developing more discreet, more accurate weapons to use them first, but your adversary, looking at the array of what you have amassed, may become convinced that you're prepared to use them first, which then gives him the incentive to move first. Now that, again, is part of this discussion of the standard arms control consensus and the pressure that is put on it. The standard arms control consensus is you don't deploy weapons that your adversary could mistakenly understand to be first strike weapons, and therefore you look at the character of the weapons you deploy, and you should stay away from weapons whose primary utility would be to be used first, that kind of thing. So I think you do get a convergence of signals here that the other side could misunderstand easily. Yes, sir.
Are the Russians sensitive to a discussion of the morality of nuclear weapons?
I have no serious empirical evidence that would indicate that they are beyond general statements. Certainly they have in recent years, and sometimes in offhand statements, sometimes in policy statements, at the most general level, talked about the terrible destructiveness of nuclear weapons and what it would mean for the world if they were used. So at that level, you don't get the kind, I think, of sustained, systematic discussion that I simply outlined here and that would have to be filled out in much more detail to lay hands on. However, that quickly then becomes an assertion that it's a one-sided debate if we use the moral analysis. My response to that runs something like this. It goes back to my fundamental position that moral analysis should be complementary to other information in the strategic debate. And here's my general response to the argument about it being one-sided. I do not presume that if we do the right thing, the Soviets will do the right thing. I don't think we have a lot of historical evidence for that. I do think it is possible to argue, looking at the history of the arms race, that when we do the wrong thing, they do the wrong thing. And when they do the wrong thing, we do the wrong thing. Now, my two cases are Mirving and heavy missiles. That is to say, I already argued that it was possible for us to move in a direction to not do what we could have done, deploy MIRVs. We decided to deploy. Immediately after we deployed, they began, they had been trying to move in that direction anyway, but they continued to move in that direction, and then they deployed MIRVs. So now we had a MIRVed world. I think the empirical judgment on that is that it is a less secure world than an un-MIRVed world. But then they turned around, the Soviets turned around, took their Mirving capability, and built large land-based missiles, which they should have known would have scared us to death. I think they did the wrong thing in strategic terms, destabilizing action. We are now prepared to build a large land-based multi-warhead missile. I think we imitate each other's mistakes better than we imitate each other's virtues. And so my own argument is that if moral argument can help you to make wise decisions in the arms debate, I won't guarantee other people will follow your good example. I want to reduce this dynamic of us following each other's bad examples. Yes?
You discussed the Roman Catholic pastoral letter. Have you assessed the impact of the more recent, perhaps more progressive position of the United Methodist Church?
Methodist bishop. I can't say I've really assess the impact because I'm not terribly sure you've had enough time to play out the impact. The letters are somewhat different. The Methodist letter is more absolute in its judgment about nuclear weapons. It was a very serious effort undertaken and is bound to have its own impact in the debate. I am less absolute in my judgment. The reason I'm less absolute is I find it harder to square an absolute judgment with all the factors I think ought to be considered in the nuclear debate. Now, to just say this in shorthand terms, there is a lot about deterrence that makes it unattractive. But when you press the argument to the point of saying I'm prepared to delegitimize deterrence, and whether that's what they really did or not, I think you'd have to ask the Methodist authors. But when you say I'm prepared to delegitimize deterrence entirely, that seems to me to raise other moral questions, because I'm not quite sure what the next step is after you've delegitimized deterrence as a moral option. I just don't see something readily available to take its place, and as unattractive as it is, it does seem to me to be a difficult hurdle to jump over. Now, I'm not saying that if you know something's morally wrong, you should go along with it because you can't think of anything better to do. My point is, it is precisely the lack of something better to do that enters into my moral judgment about whether I'm prepared to totally delegitimize it. But it does stake out a position that is more absolute than ours. And it is within that framework that the debate, I'm sure, will continue. Yes, sir.
What is your view that SGI will result more in offensive weapons and make America superior, and therefore it is more destabilizing than stabilizing?
I think one of the problems with the SDI proposal, as I understand it, is that while you discuss it in defensive terms, as I understand the technology, there is an irreducible way in which what you have cast in defensive terms can have offensive uses. And therefore, you do open up at least a whole range of possibilities the other side has to think about, and that one you'd have to think about yourself if you got into a crisis. So I think there is a problem in thinking about it purely in defensive terms. That may be the intention behind the policy. The capability of the system, I don't think, is limited to purely defensive uses. And therefore, what most of the critics of the SDI fear, it seems to me, is not the president's full-blown design of redoing the nuclear age from offense to defense. Most critics fear, I think, that we will get stuck halfway between having opened up a new arena of competition in the nuclear age, and we're stuck with an offensive-defensive mix that is not easily directed toward strategic stability. And so that's precisely the fear that people have.
One of the true mentors of Father Hare and myself used to say, politics, and especially international politics, is the place where conscience and power meet. And he's demonstrated this afternoon the way in which these strategic questions and the moral questions merge and are intermingled with one another. There was a great debate in the 50s on some of these issues that some of you may have remembered. And some great figures, Reinhold Niebuhr and John Courtney Murray, people in different religious faiths and different disciplines who debated these issues. Somebody has speculated that maybe in the 1980s we're moving toward that kind of discourse, and if the discourse in the next weeks and months, which the Miller Center has tried to encourage, Sidney Drell, for instance, the head of the Linear Accelerator Center at Stanford and of an international security program, General Abramson a little bit earlier with a quite different point of view, Gerard Smith, a variety of people, plus the kind of sensitive analysis that makes one think of that Niebuhr Murray discussion whenever one listens to men like Father Hare. Perhaps this will be a contribution that is appropriate for our times and not least appropriate to hold in this place. We thank Father Hare. We look forward to his ongoing contributions and thought. Somehow or another have reached out, as practically no one else's have, through the role which the Catholic bishops have played. Thank you very much. If we could talk for a few minutes, some of the graduate students have left, I guess, but it would be of great interest to all of us to know a little bit more. Maybe each of you have individual questions about the process. George Cannon and others have said that they were envious. They wish that some Protestant group had done what you did 3 years ago, and it is 3 years ago.
It is 3 years ago now. It was published in May of 86. Mm-hmm. May of 83. Three and a half years. Well, it'd probably be useful if I talk about the process in two steps, because we now have this new committee, the one that Sid Drell spoke to on Friday, to look at where we are 3 years after. And this committee, again chaired by Bernardine, is to submit a report in next November, a year from November. So we're in the middle of it again. Well, essentially, I have to be honest and say that the process was partly planned and partly we fell into it, to be honest. I mean, guy up at Jonathan Moore up at the Kennedy mm-hmm. School. Well, Jonathan one day grabbed me and he said only the Catholics could have planned it this way. He said the way you put out those drafts, he said, and then wait just long enough to put out another draft. And he says it was always, he said, you kept it going for a year and a half. He said you had the administration going crazy. Only you guys could have thought all of that out. Well, of course, it was all accidental. Let me tell you, we didn't think any of it. No. We have a process on any document that we're writing for the bishops, that there is a group called the Administrative Board, which meets three times a year, and you have to keep them updated on what you're doing. And when you're going to consider a document like in November, like next week we'll consider the economic letter, that has to go out to the bishops in September, or mid-October at the latest. There's a constitutional date on it. What really happened was, in the part of the process that was the drafting and the response and all of that, what really happened was we were supposed to submit in November of 82 the final version for the bishops to vote on. And we had a meeting in July of 82 in which the committee gathered. We had put the first draft out in June and had not really publicized the first draft very much. We just sent it out to the bishops for comment. And we generated 600-700 pages of comment in 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. So we met in July, supposedly to go over all of this, finish up our review of all the commentary, write the new letter, and then get it out to them for a vote in November of 82. And we took one look at it, just knew we couldn't do it. So we were in a problem. We didn't have any ingenious solution. So we called the president of the conference, and we got an okay to delay the letter a year. But we put out another draft. Well, it was really the second draft, which came out in the fall of 82, that attracted the real attention. And then, by that time, it was a sort of national document. By that time, the newspapers were waiting for it, and they did editorials, and then all universities started. But we did it because we were in a mistake by that time. And we had no idea that there'd be that kind of interest. So I think what I can say at the beginning is the process started by us simply trying to do what we had to do, which was to send the bishops the document. And when we did that, we found out we were in a national argument about the document. And as I'll say this afternoon, I think that's a product partly of what was said in the document, partly about the spirit of the times in the early 80s. I am firmly convinced they could have said exactly the same thing in 73 they said in 83, or 72 rather than 82, and they never would have made the same impact, because the country was just not ready to think about the things in the 70s. So that's the first thing. And then we found out it worked. I mean, we found out that this was a wonderful system to send it out and then get the advantage of all these perspectives of people. Now, let me say that's another piece of the process, is not so much sending it out and drafting it and redrafting it, but the witness part of the hearings were planned. And so what we had done was that as soon as the committee had begun its work, which was really in 81, what we did was to hold a series of essentially executive sessions, really, of the committee. And you were working with a committee of five bishops, two people from the religious orders who normally sit as ex officio representatives on bishops' committees, and then three of us that were really sort of the core staff in technical terms: Bruce Russett from Yale,
and a man that worked in my office and my staff named Ed Daugherty, who was a former Foreign Service officer and had worked on these questions for a long time, and myself. So it was really 10 people altogether. And we would invite people in and run a kind of a round table. I always describe them as a mix of a congressional hearing and a university seminar, because we'd ask people to come in and make a presentation and then open it up for discussion with the committee. And what was amazing then, and is still more amazing now, is that you could really get anybody to come that you asked to come. That was what amazed me. I mean, anybody would come in that you asked.
Catholic or non-Catholic.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, yeah, because we were sort of looking at the field and just trying to get essentially key voices, particularly voices that disagreed with one another. So the bishops, in a compressed time, would be confronted with opposing views of a problem, but you try and invite people who would sort of help them shape the question. And so we just started out and went through a whole list of witnesses and ended up with about 40 people that we had talked to. People like Harold Brown and Jim Schlesinger, and at that whole, about 14 people out of the arms control community, Helmut Sonnenfeld, Jerry Smith. We consciously tried to get people that wouldn't agree with one another, but were in the debate so that you got some coherence of the debate.
Were there any limits? Did you rule out Teller, or did you try?
No, not at that time. Now, we're up against the Teller question now in the second day. I better get to that in a hurry. But no, we didn't rule out anybody, essentially. We didn't want anybody coming in and ranting and raving at the bishops in any sense of the term. But no, we didn't really rule out anybody. As a matter of fact, it's kind of an incremental process in which you just keep asking the committee, now, who do you want to hear from now? Not so much who, to be honest, because very often they don't know the names. You say, what do you want to hear about? In other words, what is it that you think you're not sure of at this point in time? And so we didn't rule out anybody. We also set aside a certain percentage of time, because they wanted to bring in people who would not be quotes in the professional arms control community. And so we had at least one session where we brought in people in the Catholic community who were really sort of activists on the peace issue and who really would not at all be interested in talking about the kinds of questions the arms control people were talking about. But on the other hand, they were part of the community for which we were writing. We also brought in a number of biblical scholars, because the scope of the letter meant that you had to deal with a range of questions. Now, let me jump ahead for a minute. The judgment of the letter is sort of conditional moral acceptance of deterrence, and then you laid out conditions.
Was that there from the beginning, or did that come in as you went along?
The phrasing of it evolved as we went along, and you can trace that in the letters, because we got involved in a question that Jim Childress would have a field day with, and that was not the sort of final judgment on the Jim and David both, not the final empirical judgment on deterrence, but the mode of reasoning you use to come to your decision. And here we ran up against some questions that bedevil Catholics and don't necessarily bedevil Protestants, in the sense that you run up against certain kinds of areas in Catholic moral thought where you will get a judgment on a question that says something is intrinsically evil and never can be done. Well, once you get into that mode of reasoning, of course, you say something's intrinsically evil, your pastoral guidance, as well as your policy guidance, is essentially to cease and desist. That is to say, whether you're in the chain of command, whether you're a Catholic congressperson, whether you are somebody in a missile silo, you say the policy is intrinsically evil. Now, the question here was, is it possible to mount a credible deterrent that does not entail within it the willingness to strike cities directly? Mm-hmm. And if you say the direct striking of cities is intrinsically evil, then you're faced with a very difficult problem in how you assess the deterrence policy. In other words, you sort of can't use a kind of Niebuhrian argument about it's a fallen Absolutely. World and there's a mixed package here, and surely there are evil aspects of this. But in the end, we can make an overriding judgment that this is the best we can do, if you get into that mode of argument. Now, what we did in the beginning was we tried a mode of argument that essentially said there is evil in the policy. There are evil aspects of the policy, evil in the sense that they're morally criticizable aspects of the policy. but we feel we can tolerate this strategy of deterrence. Now, toleration is a technical term in Catholic moral theology. Augustine and Ambrose, too, argued that in public policy, for example, if you've got a problem with prostitution in a city, that was Augustine's example, he said, you can't wipe it out, so what you do is you try and contain it in a part of the city and you tolerate the evil that will be done there. Well, people lodged, some of the moral philosophers lodged a strong critique, not many, but some, against the toleration argument. What we wanted to communicate was a sense that we had significant objections to aspects of the deterrence policy, but in the overall judgment, we were not prepared to withdraw moral legitimation from it. Well, the moral philosophers said, no, wait a minute, you can't use toleration on this, because in fact, if this is the policy of the United States, you are asking citizens to support it, you are asking people in the chain of command to be prepared to implement it, they are not tolerating someone else's evil. That's what Augustine was doing. They are implicated in the evil, so you can't do that. So our first mode of argument was toleration, and that ran into too many problems. There was great value, I think, in trying to use that term, but we couldn't sustain the argument without an enormous difficulty. That is to say, people would go to Rome and say, we don't care what the bishops say about the final judgment on deterrence. They're corrupting Catholic moral discourse here, and so that's the real problem. Well, we then shifted, and when we shifted ground, then we said, all right, how are we going to structure the argument? Well, this conditional acceptance arose partly as a result of the fact that the Pope intervened in the process. See, we had been drafting for a year. We put the first draft out in June of 82. We put the second draft out second draft came out in October of 82. The Pope, after the first draft and before the second draft, had made his statement at the UN, this judgment that under present conditions, deterrence, not as an end in itself, but as a step on the way to disarmament, can still be judged to be morally acceptable. That was his judgment. And it was very clear that that speech was given because we were writing the letter. I mean, not that the UN speech was given, but that that paragraph was in there. I mean, there wasn't much doubt about that. So we had to then deal with that as given. I mean, that was already part of the judgment. So then the question is, what do you do with it? Essentially, what we tried to do was to take that judgment and then to apply it to much more detailed analysis of the structure and elements of deterrence policy than the Pope was willing to do. And so we said, all right, we'll take that judgment, but then we're going to set some conditions to this moral acceptability. And that's where the strictly conditioned moral acceptance, the phraseology of we came to conditional moral acceptance, and then people who were more uncomfortable with deterrence said we want to tighten it up more, and you get this strictly conditioned moral acceptance. Mm-hmm. And then you play out a series of conditions. Well, a year ago in November, the bishops said, we gave a certain kind of judgment to deterrence. That's hardly meant to be simply a comforting judgment. We want to look at the conditions. Mm-hmm. So then they reconstituted the Bernardine Committee with some new members in January. And we are now in the process of looking at whether the conditions are fulfilled. The way we're going about it is to say, all right, what areas would you look at? We're looking at four areas. That is to say, the period from 83 to 86. We're looking at four areas. One is arms control policies of both sides, since we had a very strong push on the necessity to work assiduously in arms control. What are both sides doing? That's becoming a very complicated thing to try and figure out. But anyway, that's part of it. Secondly, weapons modernization on both sides. Who has done what? Now, on this one, increasingly we feel that you can't take the 83 to 86 period, that if you're going to assess this, more safely ought to go back to the late 60s or early 70s, since the Reagan proposition is that everything the U.S. is doing from 80 to 86 is a response to what the Soviets did from 70 to 80. Now, we've had some interesting people into the committee to talk about how you evaluate that period from 70 to 86, and you get very different judgments. And we've had people argue that the Soviets have used restraint, and we've got other people who say the Soviets have just gone all up. Third area is technological developments that might shift the arms race, and that's SDI. Now that's where we're in. That's why we had Sid Drell in the other day. We're going to have George Keyworth in 2 weeks. But that's the third area.
I'm afraid
that's fine. That's fine.
He's got a class.
That's fine.
Working for the PhD.
All right. Having been that way, go to class. And then the fourth area is the economic impact of the arms race in terms of, say, the U.S. budgetary debate, but also in terms of what the U.S. is doing with money and foreign policy in terms of foreign aid, that there is none, and all real honest to God foreign aid. So those are the four areas, and we'll try and assess the conditions in light of the four areas. What we're really trying to do on SDI is, I hope by the end of the process, the hearing process, that they will have heard from like 12 to 15 people with different views of SDI. And
that's where you might have a teller or not.
That's right. Well, certainly we've now had
Keyworth.
We've had Keyworth, because actually he was the most prominent spokesman for the administration from the time the president gave the speech for about the next 12 to 18 months. If you take the Office of Technology Assessment Study on Space Defense and SDI, and you go through the references, Keyworth is the major figure, so we really want to get him in. Now, we had Sidrell in Friday. Prior to that, we had Jim Schlesinger and Brent Scowcroft in, mm-hmm. who didn't talk on SDI totally, but they did talk about SDI. Mm-hmm. And then we had a panel on SDI of Keith Payne, who's just done a book on it. He works with Colin Gray. He's at, mm-hmm. and, you know, they're 100% for it. And matter of fact, Payne, who's an awfully nice guy, I like him a lot. He's just finished a book commissioned by the Evangelicals on the SDI. So now you're into ecumenical debate with a fervor here. But anyway, we had Keith Payne, Bruce Russett, and then Al Carnesale, because that gave you sort of, Payne was all for the SDI, Russett was all against it, and Carnesale really does a kind of agnostic approach toward this, in which he lines up, he's worked out 10 questions for anyone to answer on SDI, and they're really kind of fun. Like, the first one is, what is it? Yeah. Will it work? Who understands what we're trying to do? And then he works out. But it's a very good list of questions. So they had the panel, now they've had Drell, then they'll have Keyworth, and then we'll try and work our way through some other people. So we're going through exactly the same process, again, in some sense. I don't think the sort of public drafting process will be as elaborate, because this is not a pastor letter. This is essentially a report. I see it being the size of the Scowcroft Commission report, mm-hmm. and of a nature of that kind of document. But I'm sure it'll get out there for commentary. It's just that I don't think it's as expansive. They said we don't want to write another pastoral, partly because these guys, they just have time problems. This committee is, in my view, a stronger committee, because it is six people rather than five. Of the five original people on the Brennan Committee, one man, Bishop Fulcher, was killed in an automobile accident 6 months after the letter came up. And he was a delight on the first committee. He had been trained in moral theology and was able to make good moral comments. But he never got too deeply involved in the policy debate. Well, he was gone, and rather than adding just one, we added two. So the new committee is Bernadine in the chair, O'Connor, Riley and Gumbleton from the original committee. And then the two new people are the new Archbishop of Los Angeles, Mahoney, Roger Mahoney, who's been very involved in social questions, not in the defense questions, although he did do his own pastoral letter on nuclear questions, as several of the bishops did a year before ours came out, and it was extremely well done. He put together a number of university people and did it. And then the other person is John Roach, who was the president of the Bishops' Conference at the time. And Roach is very good about policy things. He's got a feel for how to deal with the policy arena. So it's a stronger committee, in my view. And
does it still have this setting deterrence aside as one of the issues that you debated, and the moral character discerned? Does it still have the opposite kind of criticism that you're not quite strong enough? The media may have had it all mixed up, but mm-hmm. O'Connor and Crowell.
On the committee, the polar opposites that the media always supposed to have was O'Connor and Gumbleton, because Gumbleton has declared himself to be an unprincipled pacifist, although he stays in the policy debate in a way that sort of a straight Mennonite pacifist might not be comfortable with. But and then O'Connor, of course, comes from 30 years of military background and a PhD in international relations, so he comes at it in a different way. Mm-hmm. That debate is still embodied in the committee. I mean, those two people are still there, although the media, I think, plays out. I mean, they imagine what the committee meetings look like, and they don't always look like the way they imagine. But there are clearly differences of view there.
Some question about getting too specific on reduction of arms? Or?
Well, the question of specificity is a methodological question embodied in the whole writing process, and it was a question that surfaced very strongly when we went to Europe and met with the European bishops. After we had put out the first two drafts, then the Vatican asked us to go and meet with the European bishops. And so we went to the Vatican. It was under the auspices of the Vatican that the meeting was held. The European bishops had enormous difficulty with the specificity of the argument of the American bishops. They felt it it ran beyond their competence, that it endangered an overly political tone to the document, that they weren't comfortable. Of course, they were not at all comfortable either with the public drafting procedure. They said they just couldn't conceive of doing anything like that. Well, on both counts, our people said, no, on both counts, we think we're in the right place. There's a fascinating exchange in all of this. We have a documentary service at the Bishops' Conference called Origins. And the Origins issue, it comes out weekly, the Origins issue of April 7th, I think, of 83, gives you the full report of this meeting that took place in the Vatican, where you see this exchange made. And our people said on the specificity issue that they felt that the state of the public debate on the nuclear question in the United States had reached such a level in the public argument of sort of explicitness and widespread debate that unless they were willing to deal with the specifics, they would make no impact on the debate whatsoever. I'm still convinced of that. I just don't think you can write these letters only at the level of assured confidence in moral principles and expect to cut into the debate. I mean, you can write the letter, it's just that it won't be dealt with. And I noticed we're getting a good review from George Quester. Quester has just done a review of four pieces, the Methodist letter, our letter, Bob Tucker's book, and I forget what the fourth one is. And it's going to be published in the Bulletin of the Arms Control Association. Hmm. And Quester clearly doesn't agree with all the judgments in our letter. I know that I go over and lecture in his class at the War College, and we've talked about this often, but he's quite positive about the document. I don't even think a document of purely general principles, I don't even think a George Quester would read. I mean, he's just not, I mean, it's hard enough to get people engaged in this line of argumentation, and I think the specifics are crucial.
Is it getting harder to deal with the specifics when you, after Reykjavik?
Well, I think, generally speaking, I see this report as a much tougher document to write than the pastoral, because in a sense, the keyhole is much tighter when you line up these four categories, and when you take as the basic mandate for the report that you're going to take the moral judgment of the pastoral as a given and then test the conditions. There is a difficulty here in the sense that it drives you so deeply into the technical debate to make an assessment on conditions that even I at this point have to be worried that the bishops don't sound like it's a report from the Arms Control Association. They've got to watch how they cut into this. I think the Reykjavik thing, happily we're going to have a few months before we have to put final print, because I think right now, I mean, I've tried to read everything that's come out. I don't think anybody knows what the state of the play is. I mean, I think that the administration's proposal that they surfaced, that they must have tabled now in Iceland, the one that was written up yesterday in the New York Times, I think the attempt of that is to, in a sense, say whatever we said at Iceland, this is what we really mean. I mean, because I think whatever we said at Iceland, my guess in that session, Gorbachev and Reagan would play in poker and, you know, one-upsmanship, and they probably did say we'll do away with all of them. And then you go upstairs and somebody says, what are you going to do with NATO?
The non-speech
was a remarkable speech. I mean, it really was. I mean, to go out and quote the president and obviously, I suspect if you're Larry speaks, you don't know what was said. But you're trying to do your best to hold it together. So my sense is there's a problem in trying to figure out Reykjavik right now. What's interesting to me about Reykjavik is what I'll talk a little bit about this afternoon is that I think that the problem of the sort of what I'll call the standard arms control consensus is under a lot of pressure from various sides today. And so that to me is the intellectually interesting problem. I don't know if you saw a piece by Jim Schlesinger last week. Apparently it appeared in Time magazine also, but it appeared in the Washington Post, in which Schlesinger, in a sense, he's a little bit like a bishop after he's heard a few theologians talk, and then he wants to get the line straight again. I mean, he wants to restore the faith. So Schlesinger says in this essay, essentially, don't let anybody kid you. There is nothing beyond deterrence. There just is nothing beyond it. There's no way around it. There's no way out of it. There's no way over it. Deterrence is as far as we can go. And anybody who tells you anything differently is leading you down a primrose path. So let's keep the ideas clear in this debate. And he essentially then just castigates the Reykjavik exercise. Well, that's an interesting proposition. I mean, it is to me an interesting open question about whether there is or there isn't anything beyond deterrence. And it may well be that Schlesinger's right, that you just can't think your way through any other way in a world in which we know how to make nuclear weapons. There's no way to think about it except this way. But what's fascinating to me is the need to reassert the faith. I mean, because it is being shot at from so many angles of vision. So I think that's the interesting thing, not the specifics of what they said, but the fact that when you make a proposal of that nature, whether for propaganda purposes or not, it reopens the debate. Now, I'm going to use in the lecture this afternoon two or three things that illustrate that. Tom Schelling's piece in Foreign Affairs, you know, What Went Wrong with Arms Control. And then Kissinger, quite surprisingly to me, before Reykjavik, arguing that the problem is that the arms control people are holding on to old ideas and they won't let go of them. Well, he helped develop the old ideas. He doesn't mention that when he wants to let go of them, because he wants to make room for the defensive option. Yeah. And then this reaction from Schlesinger on the other hand. You really have an interesting intellectual debate. I do a course at Georgetown on that really is sort of it's to look at the history of the nuclear age mainly as an intellectual question. That is to say, rather than, I don't try and trace all the policy proposals, but I try and look at the way people think about nuclear weapons. And if you look at it that way, this is an interesting period. Maybe a little scary. I mean, because
I told my class that I thought more than any time I could remember why we were in a state of flux.
You
had Kissinger's proposal about being absolutely sure that the level of the defensive development should be proportionate to
the
any kind of reduction or increase in offensive weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a whole quite new.
Well, clearly, I mean, it isn't just the ABM treaty. It's a whole set of ideas behind the ABM. That's the really interesting part, whether the treaty stays or goes. That treaty was the implementation of a conviction that defense was not only impossible but mischievous. Mm-hmm. And it may well still be mischievous, and that's part of the problem, I think.
Yeah.
That's
the, how central, just to come back to the process again, how central is the draftsman? If you weren't there, just as, for instance, when Kissinger wrote Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy for the study group of the Council on Foreign Relations, if people like the two of you hadn't been there, would the process work? Would it?
Well, you need somebody. When you're dealing with bishops, you have people who are used to ideas and used to policy discourse. They're not, at least a form of policy discourse, because they make policy decisions all the time. But obviously, when they go into an area like this, you need somebody in the room who sort of knows the history of the debate, at least to a certain degree, and the terms of the debate, so that they don't start hearing things that can't be interpreted in any form. Now, it's always a tricky problem. I think you fulfill, the draftsman fulfills that one task. I mean, you sort of can keep people. You can interpret things for people, and in terms of at least basic terms, ideas, that kind of thing. I think secondly, Obviously, people in their position are not, for the most part, going to sit down and write from scratch. Although there really has been an overemphasis on the draftsmen who were not the bishops. There are parts of that letter that were written by bishops. Mm-hmm. John O'Connor put his hand to writing parts of it. Gumbleton put his hand to writing parts of it. So that there really are parts of it that, at least in some form or other, the original text is from a bishop. Mm-hmm. But it's also true that as the thing evolved, what essentially we tried to do, and generally my style of working with the bishops, is to try and frame the question all the time. It seems to me that with what people in that position can do is it's going to be their document in the end. And so what you really want to do, although my critics don't think I do this, but in all honesty, I really do try. At a certain point, you say, here's the question, here are your options, what way do you want to go? I mean, just let's decide as a general purpose what way you want to go. Once we get a general sense of where we want to go, then we can structure the argument. But I mean, essentially what you really try and do is to shape the question, and then, and I at least try and do it as neutrally as I can, and then say, all right, now given that shape of the question, and given these options, and given what you've heard, where do you think we ought to move? And then, of course, the draftsman comes into play again, because then they say, we want to go in this direction. Then they really do want you to go away and put it on paper and have them look at it. They do much better looking at a text. I mean, they're really quite good at that. They will look at a text and sometimes just say, it just doesn't sound right. Or it may be right in itself, it doesn't sound right for me to say it. I mean, on another issue entirely, I remember on a Central America thing, for Archbishop Hickey once, I was supposed to draft the testimony for him. He was due to testify. I drafted the testimony, which was a kind of running critique of this Reagan policy in 82. He looked at it and he just said, I can't give it. He said, that's just not me. I can't give it. He, and then others of my superiors, then agreed that I should give it before the committee. 2 weeks later, there was another committee with another request to testify. After Hickey told me I can't give that, then I said to him, what do you want to do? He outlined 4 major points. I went and drafted a different testimony, and he came in and gave it. So we both testified. But the testimonies really are different. The first one was just too technical for him. It was just too secular, almost, in its commentary on the policy. Well, they can do that. They can say, you might be right, but we can't say it that way. That doesn't. On the other hand, they can look at it and say, yeah, we're basically comfortable with it. We want that changed and that changed, and we don't understand how you move from here to here. They're very good at that. So it's a kind of a mix. It is not, at least with our people, it is not that you come in and hand them a document and they say, yeah, that's what we need. That really doesn't, because Bernardine's style is when he finally gets a text in front of them. He literally sits them around the table and says, all right, page 1, line 1, has anybody got any objections? And you literally go through every line and let every person comment on the lines. And so
it can take hours.
Oh, it takes hours and hours and hours. Yeah, oh yeah, it does. It does take hours. Now they go through phases. Like the phase we're in on the committee right now, for the most part, they listen. I mean, Friday they were in. From 10 to 11, they had Jim Daugherty from St. Joseph's College. He talked about technological developments in the arms race. From 11:15 to 12:15, they had Bruce Blair, who's done this book on command and control. Then they have 45 minutes of lunch. At 1 o'clock, they had Sid Drell for an hour and a half. Drell leaves, and then they had John Steinbrenner for an hour. Well, the day's over then. That's the day that they've had. They're coming back on December the 5th. They will start with Keyworth in the morning. Then they will have an hour of discussion, because we've now had 2 meetings without any discussion. So an hour of discussion. 1 o'clock they have McNamara, and at 2:15 we'll put together a panel of Alton Fry and Jan Lodl for an hour and a half. And then they'll go home again. So this is the listening phase. Then that closes off, and then you get into drafting. And so then they're prepared to come in and spend 6 or 7 hours talking about a draft. Right, straight through. They would just go through the whole draft. So there's a clear role for a draftsman. It's the sort of classical expert's role with all the liabilities and problems that lie within that role. I think some of what Kissinger writes is because he comes out of that frame of reference. You know, he's done that.
If you had to write a job description or personnel requirements for your part of it. Would a couple of the elements be professional training and background, association with your peers in the field whom you
work absolutely.
With?
Absolutely. Because
when you call these people and ask them to come, they'll come for you, but they might not come for...
That's been a great help. Yeah, that's been a great help. I mean, it has been... I clearly would say that job description, you first of all, for this kind of job, you need some interdisciplinary background. You've got to be comfortable in more than one field because the document is going to be tested according to more than one field. I think secondly, sort of participation in the wider community on a regular basis where you've been tested yourself or get tested is a second thing. And then that builds up relationships and all kinds of things that come. And thirdly, generally, that you've published yourself because you want at least the experience of having tried to write something that gets out in the public and get criticized, then you have some sense. And then finally, in this particular job, there's a certain way of writing church documents that are different than writing other... I mean, I really shift gears when I sit down and write a formal paper for a talk like this. I mean, it's really not quite the same as writing for bishops. There's a whole... And in our polity, particularly, you've got to know that you've got to write in a way that it will be understood and finally approved in the Holy See. I mean, you really do have to keep your eye on that whole other set of questions that get asked.
And that requires constant reading of what is
said. Oh, yeah. You've got to know the text on that side. I mean, you've got to know where people are, and you've also got to know what kind of style... Because some of it they just don't understand. I mean, some of it, you can write it in a certain way and they would say, well, I mean, it just doesn't sound like a church document. Now, that's not, it isn't that they don't understand. Somebody like Cassaroli, who is the Vatican Secretary of State, he is capable of independent analysis and performance on this issue by himself. I mean, the arms issue is an issue he really, really understands. I mean, Cassaroli could come into a seminar in any graduate school that I know of in the United States on the nuclear question and hold his own. He's just been through it enough times that he wrote most of the papal stuff that has been said about the nuclear question, I think, in the last 3 or 4 years.
What about passion for anonymity?
Well,
getting near that 50th anniversary of the President's Committee report.
Yeah. It is a good virtue to have. It is even if you try and have it, sometimes it doesn't work out all that well, and you have to watch out. You really have to be careful about those things. It got more public than I would be comfortable with myself. I didn't know any way around that because people tended to focus in on it. But it is better if you are one step away from the process. Because to some degree it becomes a diversion from the letter. It becomes a diversion, and then the articles tend to be staff versus the bishops, or staff running the bishops, or if so-and-so is that influential, where did he get his ideas? And then you find your graduate teachers being examined for their ideas by reporters who really don't know the field themselves. And you know, so you get into that. That's a very tricky kind of business.
Writing ability.
Yeah, I mean, then they watch you, and then they watch how you write and how other people write and whether you write. But writing ability is crucial in the process. You know, it's a mediating process. It varies with the way the committee is run. Archbishop Weakland runs a different kind of committee than Archbishop Brennerty. I mean, it's just different kinds of styles. So Weakland very often will have somebody write a draft of a chapter, bring it in, review it, and then he'll give the draft to somebody else on the committee to write. Mm-hmm. So that you really end up there with kind of a layered authorship. I mean,
that affect the unity of the draft?
Well, in the end then, somebody does play a major role, and the unity has a lot to do with time, how much time you have. The Weakland committee has had a lot more time than the Bernardine committee had, because actually the decision to write both letters was taken at the same meeting of the bishops in November of 80. So the Weakland committee really is now finishing essentially 5 years of work. They began in 81, the Bernardine committee began in 81. So we had and the reason time affects unity is that if you have time to get the basic concepts and the basic arguments set, but people are still saying editorially you've got a long way to go, well then if you've got the leisure to say, what I've really got to do here, my assignment is really not to change the policy but to write this document in a way that it holds together. We had problems with that on the nuclear order. We simply were running out of time at the end. We were right down. See, we had scheduled a special meeting of the bishops. They debated the draft in November of 82. Normally, they would have gone till November of 83, but the pressure on this thing was so high that people said, we can't wait that long. People want to put this thing out. So then we scheduled this special meeting in May of 82. So we had from November till May to produce the thing. We had to go to Rome, have the meeting in Rome, digest the results of the Rome meeting, put out a third draft, get the commentary from the third draft, and put out a final draft that had to go to the bishops almost a month before the May meeting. So we were really up against it, and that was it.
We mustn't keep too long, but how do you feel about this response? I would think one of the most satisfying parts of the whole effort would be this opinion poll or survey which showed that by no means 100%, but 60 in the 60s,
the shift. Yeah, that was actually it's an interesting thing. That opinion poll, if I think we're talking about the same one, was done by Andy Greeley, and it was done by Greeley has great difficulties with lots of the things that are done at the Bishops' Conference. He hasn't agreed with many of the things we've done, and so
has he agreed with anything?
Well. He was quite honest enough to say that as part and parcel of his generally skeptical attitude toward the bishops, he set out to do this empirical study in order to discredit them. Mm-hmm. And he said, much to his amazement, he found a greater shift in opinion in the Catholic community on this than on anything else he had studied. And he said that in his mind it was one of the largest shifts of opinion that he was aware of in statistical analysis. It's a fascinating, and he admitted it and said, I give him credit. He came out and wrote an article on that. That was really remarkable. The second thing that is the response from what I'd call a professional community. your text is right on my shelf. I can get Ken Thompson to sign off on a text, I figure we're all right. We're not going to sink. Yours is there, and people like Quester and people like Joe Nye and Stanley Hoffman and Mac Fundy was very, very, and Kennan. Mm-hmm. The Kennan article was invaluable. Yeah. The article he published in the
Post
came 2 days before they voted on it in Chicago. That was just wonderful. Where the disappointment comes, and it's partly an organizational question. We did not penetrate the parishes with this in a way that you'd really want to do it.
They're just not that interested.
Well, no, it isn't. I don't think it's that. I think we'll see. We now have an interesting case study coming. I think part of it was we were so immersed and absorbed in getting the document out that we really didn't have time to lift our eyes and think about how you effectively move it through this community. It was so public and it was such a high wire act that you were just totally absorbed in doing that. Secondly, in terms of job descriptions, I tend to think that it takes a different kind of person to plan those kinds of things than necessarily the person who's staffing it. So I take a good deal of the responsibility myself. I just don't think I had even thought much about that.
You should be 10.
Well, you really have to need different people. Now, what we've done on the economic letter is partly as a result of that. About 6 months ago, the bishops constituted, maybe even almost a year ago, the bishops constituted a different committee from the Weakland Committee and entrusted that committee or mandated to think through an implementation process. So next week, when the bishops come to Washington, they will vote on the economics letter, and then they will vote on an independent document that is an implementation document that is the fruit of three bishops and staff thinking through and writing to Catholic colleges and universities and writing to people in diocesan positions of responsibility saying, how can we move this? And so now there's a whole, and we'll see whether that makes a difference. I think in 82, 83, you really didn't have any trouble generating interest. It was a question about how you got to that level. Northern Virginia is a unique case. It's not a good standard model for the United States, but in Northern Virginia, 82 or 83, you could get 200 or 300 people a night to turn out in a parish for a discussion and a letter. Hmm. Now, partly it was because they were so professionally engaged in it. I clearly had evenings where 80% of the audience were military. I mean, very interested. Very. The military have taken the document very seriously. Hmm. It is used in the National War College. It's standard reading on the reading list in the National War College. The chaplains all read it. As far as I can tell, all the chaplains get to read it as part of their training period. It has been read in the military. A number of military people have written, in like when they're in a year at the War College or something, they write their papers on the bishop's letter. So there's been an interesting exchange at that level. It was Herman Kahn came to see me when we were writing it to tell me that he had been hired by the Pentagon to help them to deal with the document. He had this breakfast group of colonels that he used to meet with. Essentially, the assignment was public opinion and nuclear weapons, but the bishop's letter was the key to it. Yeah. That was a kind of funny anecdote. Kahn used to come. Kahn was fascinated by the document. Right. And he came to see me, just appeared in the office one day, all 300 pounds of them, and said, it was after the second draft was out, and he said, you guys, he said, have a chance to change the direction of American nuclear policy. But he said, if you're going to do it, you have to change the letter. He said, you've got some good stuff in there, and you've got some bad stuff in there, and if you take the good stuff and stay with it, you can change the direction. And then he told me, he said, I'm working for them. He said, I'm consulting, and I'm talking. He essentially wanted a letter that took the principle of non-combatant immunity, pressed it very hard, and argued for a change in targeting doctrine. He said I myself would press the principle of non-combatant immunity about 90% of the way. He said, you guys can press it 100%. And he said, so I won't agree with the last 10%, but I'll argue that that's what we ought to do. Secondly, the other principle was no first use.